with town council?
Well, I say Helen McCain said, we better go on. We better go on town council. We need a woman on there. So I said, okay. But I would never be mayor because, damn it, I was up and down, in and out, all through council meetings. So I was deputy mayor for a long, long time. That's where I first met Pete Federitz. You know Irene's husband? Mm-hmm. I loved him. He had such a violent temper. Whoosh, and he calmed right down.
And tell us about Alice Donahue getting on the library board.
Oh, that was interesting. The library board, the town hall, was an old schoolhouse about the size of this room, which was behind where the post office is now. And they were having an annual meeting. And they didn't get a quorum to their annual meeting in January. So Alice Donahue came over to my house. I was living over the theater because my office was in the theater. And she says, come on over and join the library because we need a quorum. So I said, okay, me and my dog Gypsy will come and then you'll have one more. So I went over there and that's how I got on the library board.
And you stayed on that board until?
Until I can't remember when.
Sometime in the 1990s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're on that board a long time.
Yeah. Because I liked reading and because I thought other people should like reading.
Mm-hmm. Want to tell us about the rec board? When you were in town council, how you got there?
Yeah, I was on the rec board when I was juvenile on town council. And what you were responsible for was hockey, skating for kids, softball, and baseball. And of course, all of the other stuff sort of ran itself except the skating rink because of the children. So that's how I got on the rec board. And one of the funniest things that happened on this recreation committee was two people came to council. One was named Ken Batram, and I can't remember the other one's name offhand. Know him well. They wanted to borrow some money to buy some instruments for a town band. And everybody threw their hands up and said, you can't spend money on that. Recreation is hockey, football, skating. And I thought, well, that's a pretty narrow view. So I went and got the Town and Village Act and found out how you got a recreation board. So I forced them to form a recreation board so we could do some reasonable spending of money on something beside hockey and football and softball. It wasn't very easy either. However, I put the application in and they let me have my way, and that's where I first met Helen Hyde. We had to do a survey. We had to survey every adult in the town of Athabasca. And I was too busy to do that, so I said, Helen, will you do this? And she organized the whole darn thing and did a wonderful job. Brought us up all the figures we needed, and guess what they wanted? Can you?
Swimming pool.
A swimming pool.
Which they didn't get for quite a while, but...
No, they didn't get the swimming pool, but they got a recreation board. Mm-hmm. And things were a little different. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we never got an orchestra under there, but we got a lot of other things after we got a rec board. So that's how I got on the rec board, because I created the damn thing.
Do you want to tell us something about the Pottery Club?
Oh, the Pottery Club was quite interesting. When I had some empty space in my building, I rented it to a man named Ed Polanski. Ed put the first TV into the town with towers. He couldn't get any TV in the valley. So he put towers in, and he rented space in my office. I had space there So he read Space in the Office, and I got to be quite good friends with Ed. The Pottery Club. Oh, while Ed was there, a man named... Funny. He was a local man who had connections with Switzerland, and he went back to Switzerland, and he brought back a bunch of Swiss low-fire pottery. He showed this to Ed Polansky, and Ed Polansky says, there's no reason why we can't have a pottery club. So, a pottery
business.
So he started getting organized for that. And at the same time, I was saying, if they can do that with our mud, why can't we do it ourselves? So I started the pottery club, and Ed started the business of the pottery. Of course, that was an auxiliary business. His real business was providing the town with TV.
Right.
Because you couldn't get anything in the valley.
And his pottery business lasted for a few years?
Oh, quite a few years. Mm-hmm. And the pottery club is still in existence.
Yes.
I think our first tub for mixing pleary, as the mud and clay and water, and you mix it all together and then sieve it so that you don't have any lumps in it. Our first thing that we put in our mud in was an old bathtub down in the back room of the community center where there was no heat. Down in the basement. Mm-hmm. We had this big tub and we put...
In the basement of the community center was built then? Okay.
Mm-hmm. The community center was built and we had our tub down there and we had got a kiln on time and we managed to pay for it by memberships. We got a kiln and we fired every so often. When we got a load, we fired. The guy who was the biggest help with that pottery club was, just about said his name and now it's gone.
Was it Mr. Goodell, was it?
No.
No, okay.
It was a farmer who lived out east. Down at Maryland. You should have done this 10 years ago and I could remember something. Anyway, this man and I, we mixed the mud up, and you mixed it up, and you had to sieve it, so forth. And we would make a big mound of mud that you could start shaping. First of all, you had to clean it with water. Then you had to put it on plaster of Paris bats to absorb the water till it got to a certain thickness. Then you wrapped it up and tucked it away, and people went to work on it again. Our first wheel was made by Frank Hagen, that's the guy. He made the first wheel out of an old washing machine. It worked.
Mm-hmm.
Mind you, it didn't work as the ones they have now, but it did work.
Where did you get the clay?
Down the road here. You know, between the old road to Collington and the railroad track. There's huge deposits of very good low-fire clay. That means low-fire means it's fired, it's reddish, brick-colored.
Mm-hmm.
But you could put a nice glaze on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they still have the pottery club, that's Rosie Gay.
Right, they do.
It's still the same old club, and I'm sure Rosie's done a lot with it.
Tell us how they built the community center.
Yeah. The community center was built right after the war, and they used to use on top of Parker's store for movies and all kinds of plays, etc. Well, when the war came over, Charles came back and got married. Old man Parker booted them out of there, and Charles moved in. So Then they started thinking about a community center. And the town donated the land. And they borrowed some money and bought cement and wood. And the people of the town and the county, because there's not much separation with us, all worked together until they put that basement up down there. And the community center was the basement for a long time. Till they got it paid off and could borrow some more and finish the top. So, and that started, oh, I came in 49.
47.
47. That started about 49 or 50.
And what did they do to raise money for the community center?
I think it was a lot of donations, but the biggest donation was labor. Mm-hmm. Everybody for miles and miles around came and put all the time they could. Taking wheelbarrows of cement here and wheelbarrows of cement there. It was built, most of the labor was voluntary labor for the bottom.
Did you work on it?
No. I couldn't.
You were busy.
I couldn't commit myself to any long period of time. Mm-hmm.
You were telling me different people who did, though, you remembered.
I remember George Goodell.
District Ag Rep.
Yeah. Little short Swiss man with a nice little bay window. And he just went like crazy with that wheelbarrow, dumping the cement into the forms. There was a lot of volunteer labor. Mm-hmm. Names of some of the people I can't remember, I didn't know well. There was a carpenter who did a lot of work there. She had asked me this 10 years ago, I would have remembered.
You were telling me one time about the concert party. Was that not one way that they raised money to try and pay off the mortgage on the community center?
Partly. Mm-hmm.
What was the concert party?
It was a group of people who liked to do plays. They put on plays. And Nancy Appleby put on various dancing episodes that went with the concert party shows. I don't know. Big guys on the concert party was Vince Priest and Parker, Charles Parker. They were the momentum behind that.
Can you tell us something about the Klondike Days?
Klondike Days had to start in order to pay for the community center. And since this was Klondike Country 100 and so years ago, they decided to call it Klondike Days. And it consisted of a series of dances, like the Can-Can Girls, and a bunch of shows and plays. And they were all local community people who produced these and showed them. And it was, they worked like hell, and they'd be lucky if they get 3 days to show, because there weren't that many people here.
Mm-hmm.
There was 800 in the town and about 5,000 in the county.
And they started these after the basement of the community center was built?
Yeah.
And they ran them in the basement? Was that before they'd even built the top of it? They used the basement before they'd finished the top?
Yeah.
And as they got money, they kept adding on?
Yeah. Yeah. It was kind of built kind of differently. Part of the basement had no heat in it. The part that the ceramics club was in had no heat. We had to leave the doors open to keep our mud from freezing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, down inside doors open.
Mm-hmm.
And that's back to the Pottery Club.
We were just talking about Klondike Days and raising money to pay off the community center mortgage.
Yeah. Well, Klondike Days was put on by a a group of artistic people in the town, like Nancy Applebee and Vince Priest, believe it or not. A few other. I'm sorry, Marilyn. These things don't come easy anymore.
And they did pay off the mortgage.
They did pay off the mortgage. Yeah. In fact, we were going to have a big ceremony and burn the mortgage, and I couldn't go because I had to have a baby. So I didn't get to see the mortgage burned.
You delivered a baby that day.
Yeah. That hour.
Want to tell us about the Athabasca story, when Athabasca had its 50th anniversary?
Oh, yes. That was the brainchild of Dave Hunter. And he got in touch with somebody in Edmonton who got in touch with a Welshman.
John Havard.
Yeah. And John Havard came and produced it. And it was beautifully done. And like Irene Delancey's daughter,
Margot,
and said, "Who's going to come and watch this? We're all here."
Everybody was in it.
Yeah.
So tell us about some of the things that happened when that was on.
The Athabasca story? Mm-hmm. Well, it was the 50th anniversary of the inauguration of the town.
Mm-hmm.
And we put on this great big pageant. It took a lot of effort. And it was produced by this man named John Havard and written by somebody in Edmonton. And it was a great success. It wasn't just the Athabasca story, but the whole town got together. Max Future turned his bakery into a meat bake shop, and they sold food all over town. We must have had 1,000 people an hour coming through almost. But I didn't really see much of that because I was involved in John Havard's production. And believe me, you had to be oil for troubled water between Havard and a bunch of other people. I remember one day he stamped his feet and he said, "You tell that boat to come across the river on the fourth bar of Beethoven." And I said, "John, I don't know the fourth bar of Beethoven from Mary Had a Little Lamb." He says, "Okay, wait." I'm no musical genius.
But the boat came over on time.
Boat came over on time. The big problem was, it was September the 5th, and the river was dropping every day by 6 to 8 inches, so the timing had to be adjusted every day to get them to arrive on time.
And who was in the boat? Who was supposed to be arriving?
A Hudson's Bay boat.
Mm.
And there was a canoe or two,
mm-hmm.
but it was a Hudson's Bay boat that
Figured in the story. And there was some story about somebody not getting in the boat?
Frank Appleby. He was getting so anxious. They were all getting so anxious to do it right. Frank went to push it off and left Frank behind. He had to go barefooted across the bridge. Which did not. He didn't really approve that procedure. Well, you know, he was our MLA once, I think.
Yes. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about the Immigration Hall?
Well, the Immigration Hall was there when I came. It was down by the... about where that platform is now, at Ray's Place. And the Immigration Hall was not used as an Immigration Hall when I came. It must have been some prior time. It was rented out to cadets, Boy Scouts, and Girl Cadets. What are they called?
Were they the Air Force Cadets or the Girl Guides?
Air Force Cadets.
Air Force Cadets.
Well, one day, a hell of a thunderstorm and a bunch of wind in the immigration hall burned down. We lost three babies. Three of the sales babies died there. I couldn't believe they were dead. They looked so good, so pink and rosy. Couldn't hear a heartbeat. Like hell on them for an hour and a half. Yeah. And finally Dr. Brown said, "Hey, you're crazy, they're dead. You don't recognize dead when it's got pink cheeks."
Mm-hmm. You don't want to anyway.
No.
Do you want to tell us about Mr. Fowler?
G.G. Fowler? He came from a Setinaw up here. And he went into the lumber business out in the field. And then he developed a lumber yard where he bought from the guys who were rough hewing in the woods. And he made a lot of money. I'm not exactly sure how. And what do you want to know about him?
Well, you said he built houses for his family,
yeah.
Who were they?
Vivian Fernese, Muriel Greenlaw, that's the two houses by the bank.
They were his daughters?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he built a house by the RCMP next to them. Mm-hmm. And the RCMP and man and wife, the chief of the RCMP, lived there. In the basement was all the rest, the cell.
So it was the whole office in that building?
The whole office was in the basement. The house was
upstairs. And were those the only three places along there that he built?
No, he built three of them.
Okay, and the other was for his?
Two daughters.
And one for himself?
No, he built one for Muriel, one for Vivian, and one for the RCMP. It was just the three there.
Okay. And where did he live?
He lived in the Fowler building, which was down by the river.
Home Hardware.
Home Hardware area. Right close. Every time the river flooded, the river went right through the basement.
So I think his basement really is part of the basement of Home Hardware.
Yes, it is. It is part. It's the basement of Home Hardware.
And was he not related to the Rogers? Or?
Yes, he was.
Was that another daughter?
No, I think it was his sister. I think Mrs. Rogers was his sister.
Okay. So he'd be an uncle to Marvin?
Yeah.
And the Rogers had a business here. Which one was that?
It was a motel. Down by the Tawatna River here.
Muskeg or the Tawatna?
Muskeg.
Okay. And who had the auto court?
Bessie Rogers, old Fowler's sister. There was another auto court up here.
The auto drive-in, auto court drive-in.
Yeah.
Or auto camp, I think it was called, maybe. I can't remember. Which one was Mrs. Rogers then?
The one by the Tawatner.
Okay.
Not the one by...
And who had the one up here?
A man named Elliot.
Okay.
His wife played bridge. I can't remember her name now.
And how did Mr. Fowler... Why did he leave town?
Well, why did he come in the first place? He came from Setna area as a farmer and moved into a bush camp up here. Then he started buying the timber from other people and established the place where Home Hardware is now.
Mm-hmm.
That part that is down under,
mm-hmm.
you know, at the extreme north end of Home Hardware, was where he lived. He had a bit of a business upstairs. We had a flood once and went right through that place. Right through the whole place.
But then they left and everybody left, didn't they? His daughters and everybody.
Yeah. Father's daughters. That was Vivian Fernese and Ariel Greenlaw. Those were his daughters. And right behind where he built houses for them, he built one for his mother. And his wife lived there once in a while, and he lived in the basement under the store. They didn't like each other, they got married.
And,
there's a lot of gossip going in here, isn't there?
Oh, just a bit. Mr. Goodell, do you remember when he came, or was he here when you came?
He was here when I came. He lived in that house where Tom Connors lived now.
The Cull House over here?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Cull House.
What, could you want to name some of the doctors you've practiced with since you came?
Well, I first practiced with Dr. Wright. Then I practiced with Dr. Brand. And then I practiced with Dr. Wright again. Then Kiltz came because the three of us got together and decided we'd do well, but we didn't. And from then on, it's pretty much the way it is now. It seems to me that I was always the one that was hiring somebody. Mm. Although it wasn't true. Brian and Dr. Taylor came to Dr. Kiltz. He came over to see me one day and said, can we practice in the building? What's the difference?
And then who was with Brian? Dr. Taylor?
Taylor.
Where did he go?
He went back to England. So, it's still going around and I'm not saying anything and neither are you.
Well, I kind of...
So you want me to tell about the episode of the cat?
Right.
Well, I had empty space in my building. And it was the basement suite. And there was a vet came to town named Gajurgis. And he wanted to rent the place, so I rented it to him. And he had a wife who was also a vet. And they had one cat, which was fixed. And they called it Pompey, but they spelled it like Pompeii, as we say Pompeii. And so they said to me one day, let's fix some cats. So I had a cat corral beside my house, and I put my cats in the house and put some female cats out there, and they started singing Grand Opera, you know. So, and we kept getting cats after cats after cats. Well, DeBrookie anesthetized the whole damn works. They sterilized a bunch of them. Some of them died. But we turned loose a lot of neutered cats. All the Toms were neutered quick. So, when we got this all done, I had that, you know, that fence, that long fence beside the wall by the house in town. Well, we had that open so we could catch cats. So we caught the cats, we put them in a cage, and we neutered a whole mess of them. And they all went back where they were in the first place on that long wall, and you could see little drops of blood all on the top of it. But I think one of them died, but only one. We must have done about 40 cats, I think.
When you were telling this story, Helen recognized that that's probably what had happened to her big tomcat.
It never was a tomcat. It was
not anymore.
It was a kitten.
And it got big and heavy.
And it was one of Helen's cats. I mean, she really laughed. It was about 10 years afterwards she found out this cat she loved so much had been fixed by a pair of impish veterinarians, both DeBrookie and his wife were vets, and a compliant...
Was it DeBrookie or Gajurgis?
DeBrookie. Pajurgis was a vet too, but he was afterwards. He's the one that got bit by the mad cow. And the poor son of a gun had to take 44 anti-rabies shots. He got to the point when he's coming down to the office for a shot, he just soon would die. I think they hurt. But he had to take some 40 of them. And I don't know if we ever really had a rabies epidemic. One of Helen Light's cows was supposed to have had rabies, and that's the one that bit the vet.
Hmm. Were you involved with the health unit very much here?
No. Not the health unit. I was public health officer. I had to check all diseases that were called. Epidemic type diseases, like measles and mumps and all that. I was public health officer.
Okay, Dr. Brown, you just want to sit and
take the jacket off.
Okay.
I thought I brought something warmer because it's warm outside.
Okay. Today is January the 18th, 2001.
Right.
We're in conversation with Dr. Josephine
Mary Brown.
Born in
Riley, Alberta, 19. January the 20th, 1919.
I'm not sure we picked you up. Would you like to tell us a bit about your mother and father's stories?
Well, my mother, her maiden name was Harding. She came from a long line of people from Virginia. Her first Harding came over with Sir Walter Raleigh, and he brought a load of immigrants with him, and he stayed with his ship.
Okay, I'll stop here. Okay. So what's playing, Dr. Brown?
Okay. I was talking about my...
Sir Walter Raleigh,
and the first Harding, who came with an immigrant ship with Sir Walter Raleigh. And they went to Raleigh, Virginia. At that time, he stayed there. Virginia, of course, after Queen Elizabeth, Virgin Queen. No. In 1776, Harding's family took his ship and fled to Nova Scotia. They went to
Hantsport,
yeah. The next year, this grandsire of mine decided he had to have something. He had to have money to feed his family. So he took his ship back to Raleigh, and he was captured by the revolutionaries, and all his property was taken, and he was put on a rail, tarred and feathered, until he died. So he didn't do his family any good. Poor man. Now, at this point in time, the Hardings, who were in Nova Scotia, married up with a Welsh outfit. I can't remember the name now. Anyway, these Welshmen were quite different. I got my grandfather back in Canada, or into Canada.
Right.
Out to the States and killed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, his family remained behind. They didn't have a darn thing. They even lost a needle in the dirt floor, and it took them 3 weeks to find it. the needle is that important. So that's my mother's side of the story. My grandmother on my mother's side, his name was Chatfield, and they were Welsh, and they were very outspoken and individually acting people. Forgot where was that?
Oh, the Chatfields?
Yeah. Well, the Chatfields were very interesting. That was my mother's name was Chatfield. For one thing, they were wanderers and they were drunks and had lots of fun. So that takes my mother's story back to 1776 as Canadians. Mm-hmm. And they were Virginians before that. My father came from England, a place called Isleworth. He had some illustrious ancestors. His grandfather, was the contractor for the Crystal Palace for Queen Victoria, and also built the Midland Western Railway from London to Liverpool. For his effort for Queen Victoria, he was given a non-hereditary knighthood. Did I tell you that before?
Not today.
Anyway, my father married a woman from Yorkshire.
Your grandfather?
My grandfather married a woman from Yorkshire, and they had 12 children. By the time my father was 12, he had to leave home. They only had a 6-room house. So he was taken to his uncle, who was had the non-hereditary peerage. And my father said, grandfather said to his brother, "Can you find me a job for this boy?" He said, "Oh, I can find a job as a page someplace." My grandfather said, "To hell with you," took the boy and apprenticed him to a greengrocer at 12. Same time, in order to see if he could get ahead, this 12-year-old boy was subject to a great examination for public servants in Britain, and he just missed out by 200. There were about 3,000 applied. He just missed out by 200. So he was taken and apprenticed to a greengrocer, and he had to leave home when he was 12 because he was the oldest of 12 kids. 6-room house. You gotta leave when you're 12.
Right.
So there was a kind of a funny lawsuit in England involving my father's aunt. It's the first case of murder by neglect. Had the book gave it to my niece, don't know what she did with it, she wasn't very interested. But I thought that was interesting. The first case of murder proved by neglect.
And who was it proved against?
Against the woman and man that my great aunt was married, was working for. So they had this great big old lawsuit, and people who were accused of murder by neglect were found guilty.
And she was working for them.
She was working for them, and she lied in court.
Who did they neglect?
They neglect no relative of ours, but my great aunt was working for these people, mm-hmm. who neglected an idiot woman. Mm-hmm. And she had a lot of money, so they wanted her dead, so they starved her to death.
And your aunt lied in court?
And my Aunt Clara lied in court. and was terribly ashamed. And what she did? She promptly immigrated to the United States, Southern California, and married an old German orchard man. So that was the first actual ground that hit this continent.
Mm-hmm.
The others that hit the continent were Hardings, and they came a lot earlier.
That was your mom's family, though.
Yeah.
Then how did your dad get to the United States?
He had an aunt who got mixed up in a lawsuit, and somehow, either through correspondence, she met this old German orchard man and she married him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the Browns started coming, first one aunt and then my father.
His aunt sort of sponsored him to come or something like that, or encouraged him? Or...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So my father said something rather amusing to me. He said, "When I got off the boat in New York and got on the train, I learned the first thing I've got to do is lose my accent." His broad Cockney accent, so he had to lose that right away. He spent all the way from New York to San Francisco trying to lose his accent.
Did he succeed?
Quite well.
Mm-hmm. What did he do in San Francisco?
He played the violin in an orchestra pit until he found a fellow who wanted to start a store in Bakersfield, and Bakersfield was a gold digging town. So that's what they did, and they made a lot of money. And my father decided to go back to England because he made so damn much money. He went back to England, and when he came back, he decided he was going all the way British. He got to Edmonton and ran out of money. He telegraphed his partner, who found out that he absconded with absolutely everything.
The partner had?
Yeah. He didn't have a penny to his name. So he started working for an old his name was Busafi. He's some kind of central...
European?
No.
Oh.
Mohammed.
Mm.
He was a Mohammed.
Syrian or?
Syrian, I
mm-hmm.
think.
Mm-hmm.
See, my memory's no damn good.
It's okay. It's doing, you're doing fine. And he was a grocery, in a grocery store?
This fellow was he was wholesaling various grocery stores. And my father was sent to the store in Pinoca. So he landed in Pinoca. And he operated a store there. Now, my mother, at the same time, did I tell you she had TB?
Not yet.
Well, she was teaching on Sable Island, and she had a massive lung hemorrhage.
And how old was she?
About 21. She was born in 1883, and this was in 1905.
Mm-hmm.
So they put her on, they said to her, "You can go to Oklahoma or you can go to Alberta." She said, "I will not go to Oklahoma."
You yells wouldn't go to the States.
So she came to Alberta, and she arrived the day the province was inaugurated.
How did she come?
By train. She was on a stretcher to Winnipeg, and she got up out of bed in Winnipeg. Mind you, the trains were slow. She got off on the 5th of September, 1905. And stopped at the railway station, her stuff got off, and there was a sign in the door that said, "We've gone to the celebration of the inauguration of the province, we'll be back at 5 o'clock. So she sat and waited till 5 o'clock. So they took this, where the school she was at, they pitched her tent, she was supposed to stay outside, took her medicine, and she taught school with active TB.
And did she stay in the tent all winter?
No, she couldn't have. You can't stay in the tent all winter in Alberta.
Not really.
I don't know what she did about it. But there's no way you can do that. Anyway, she started teaching at this school. And by and by, she went through various schools in the area and finally ended up teaching in Binoka. In 1905, she was boarding at a boarding house where my father was boarding at a boarding house because he was working for this Assyrian called Abusafi. And that's how they met and that's how they got married, living in the same area. That just about covers my family history, I think. Because I never met an aunt, or an uncle, or a grandparent.
On either side of the family?
On either side.
So you grew up in?
Riley, Alberta.
And your dad had the grocery store?
Yeah.
And when you graduated from high school, what did you do?
I had a choice. I had one teacher let me skip a grade. The reason I was anxious to skip a grade is because when I was 10 years old, I was 5'6". I haven't grown since. And the option was, you can go to normal school, which takes 5 months. This is 1939. Or you can go to nursing school. That takes 3 years. Or you can be a stenographer, which only takes 3 months, but you won't get a job. So I ended up teaching school. I taught a school out of Binoka for 3 years until I saved enough money for 2 years at university.
Did you know what you wanted to study at university?
Oh yes, I knew that from the time I was 12.
That you wanted to be?
That I better be a doctor because all the kids used to bring all their junk to me because I was so much bigger than they. So I was always mucking around in the first line of accidents that children have. So I thought, well, I'll be a doctor. And I decided to teach school in order to make enough money to go to university. I went to university. Tuition was $300. I don't know what it is now, but it's 10, 20 times that.
About 4,000?
Yeah. A lot more than it is now. Mind you, I think maybe the money comes just as hard, but and not much harder than it did then. Because I can remember living and eating my first year at university for $10 a month. Mind you, when you weren't making anything, $10 was quite a bit, but comparatively, I think we were better off then. Mm-hmm. Because what kid can do that now? Impossible. Mm-hmm. An ice cream cone is $1.10. Used to be a nickel. So things have changed an awful lot. Now where am I at?
When you were at university studying medicine?
Yeah, well, I got my first 2 years in and was going to quit and teach again when the war broke out, the Second World War. And the government in its wisdom said, any medical student who will guarantee they'll work for the Army can join the Army and get $40 a month and a uniform. Well, that was just great big money. Mm-hmm. So I ended up in the Army. And before I was graduated and the Army wanted me, the war was over. So that's how I got started into medicine. Because I was an overgrown kid and all the little kids came to me. The little kids were older than me, but so that's how I got started in that.
What year did you graduate?
From university?
Mm-hmm.
1947.
And the first place you went was?
First place I went after I graduated. Athabasca.
How did you hear about Athabasca?
Well, I knew a little geography. I knew it had a river running through it, and I love water.
Mm-hmm.
And It just sounded like a pretty place to go.
Hmm.
And I had $10 when I got here. I paid my fare and I had $10.
You came, how did you come?
By bus.
I remember you telling me what your first impression was when you came in on the bus and you saw that fire on the river. It was at night, wasn't it?
It was at night, dark. My impression was, my God, there's a fire and I don't know where anything is. And young Walter Berry turned around and said to me, those are sawdust burns. So that was my first impression of Athabasca, is my God, I don't know where anything is.
Where did you go right away?
Well, Dr. Wright met me. He met me at the bus and he took me up to the hospital and they found a bed there for me. And I stayed there for a while.
And which hospital was that one?
It's where Venture Place is. It was the old Bishop's Palace. The Anglican Bishop owned that property that's on. And they converted it into a hospital. And then they sold it to a hospital district in Athabasca. And that's what belonged to when I came, as a hospital district. It was an interesting old place, of course, being a bishop's palace. It was all cut up to this and that, every which way. We had two rooms. I don't know if you should tape this. You can cut it off. At the back, on the ground floor of that hospital where we put people we knew would never be able to cope at home. And one day one of them died. And Hugo Collian and Blacklock's son-in-law came up to pick up the body. They came in the back door, which was at least obtrusive, went to the first bed, picked him up, and he says, not me, fellas, it's him. That's true. So they picked him up and took him out. That's just not important, but it always stuck in my mind as being a sign of the times.
Mm-hmm.
So I lived in the hospital for quite a while. The matron had a suite in the old hospital, which is where Venture Place is now.
Who was the matron then?
A girl named Burl Watt. And she married a man who was in the lumber business, came from around Rochester.
Mm.
The name is eluding me now, I'll remember it tomorrow. So I've got myself living in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of interesting things about fees at that time. An office visit was $2. A house call was $5. But you never got paid for them anyway, so but you went. Quite different from what it is now. Which goes to show that a dollar is not worth a dollar. You used to be able to live a week on $5. Can't anymore. Can't get through a day. So I don't know whether we're better off or worse off than we were before. Now,
where did you practice from?
I stayed in the hospital because there was no place else to stay.
But where did you run your practice?
Dr. Wright, we saw everybody in the morning. In the afternoon, he had an office in the old hotel. It was a niche cut out of the bar room. In the Union Hotel, yeah.
And you worked with him there?
Yeah. But it was kind of funny because there wasn't two offices. There was a tiny waiting room and an office in the examining room. So we used to goof off between this and that and take them one at a time. Strange. It never worked like that now.
No.
But I did go to the office because people were used to going to the office in the afternoon. They wouldn't come up to the hospital. Besides, why should the hospital pay my office expenses? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I was hired by Dr. Wright. So that's the way that started.
And he gave you a salary then?
He gave me a salary. What was it? You know, it didn't matter very much. I can't remember what it was. But I do know that we were supposed to charge $5 for an office visit. But nobody north of Rochester, north of Westlock, would charge anybody more than $2 for an office visit.
It was a poorer district, wasn't it?
They were pioneers. Mm-hmm. And they were just starving. And said, this is before the days of birth control, and it was just after the war, and people had dozens of kids. Mm-hmm. I delivered over 2,000 myself. And not many people say that now.
No.
So, I know I delivered over 2,000. It worked out pretty well to about 100 for 20 years in that neighborhood. Now, what else do you want me to tell you?
Oh, some more about practicing. Dr. Wright built a building after a while.
Yes, after a while. He built a building, and a man named Richard Hall built a theater called the Aurora Theater. And Richard had a space above that you could live in and a space below to rent out in the next to the theater part. And I rented the part next to the theater and a little cubby hole for a waiting room, and the rest was examining.
So you weren't working with Dr. Wright anymore then?
No.
You branched out on your own?
I went on my own because mm-hmm. it was so pointless. There was only two of us were seeing one patient at a time, lots of time. Mm-hmm. So it was just kind of pointless. Dr. Wright was a nice old guy.
And the building he built is the one the Farmer's Market has just vacated now.
Yeah.
In 2001. Mm-hmm. On the corner of 49th Street.
Yeah. 49th, isn't it?
Right. And so he, what did he have in that building besides his office?
He had an office, and he built a drugstore and rented it to one Bert McDonald. And he had suites upstairs.
And who lived there?
Eventually, when he sold his place to Dr. Kiltz, his house, he moved up there. And he lived there until he died, I think.
Mm-hmm. And how long were you at the Aurora Theater in that building?
About 7 years. There was a fellow in the health unit named Brand. They said, hey, let's build a building. So we put up the money, and he couldn't put up his. We built the building he wanted to leave. So I bought the rest of the building.
That was Morris Brand, wasn't it?
Morris Brand, yeah. Very pleasant chap.
And so that's the building that's now that was the basis for what's now the medical center. You added on to it later.
I added on to later when Dr. Kiltz showed up.
About what time would that be that you added on? You originally built it in what, 52 or so?
About 52.
Mm-hmm.
After I was evacuated from the theater building.
And why was that?
I'm not sure.
Hmm.
Anyway, it didn't matter because Dr. Brand wanted to build the building, so mm-hmm. we built the building, and I paid off his share, so it was my building.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in the basement there for 4 or 5 years. And I decided I didn't like living in the basement, and I built a house behind it. So, besides, I had more room to plant things.
You always like gardening.
I always liked plants.
Mm-hmm.
Trees and plants, and cats and dogs. So I got myself up that far, didn't I?
In the medical profession. So you were working with Dr. Wright. You added on to the building. About what year was that? Not Dr. Wright, I'm sorry, Dr. Kiltz, when he came.
I added on to the building when a fellow named Morris Brand in the health unit decided he wanted to go into business with me. I said, okay, we'll build a building, we'll build it half and half. He couldn't pay his half, so I paid it off. It was mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived in the basement of that.
Mm-hmm. And then when did you expand?
When Dr. Kiltz showed up, he was pussyfooting back and forth between Dr. Wright and I. And he wanted Dr. Wright's house. I don't know what kind of a deal that was. And they wanted to move into my building, so I put an addition on my building. I put an addition on so there was room for four. Enough of this building for two, and it turned out to more. So that's when I built that building.
And did Dr. Wright ever practice out of that building?
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm.
When Kiltz came, and Kiltz was going back and forth between us, and they said, hey, why don't we all practice together? So they moved into my building.
And how long did that last? The partnership?
The partnership with Dr. Wright lasted until he died.
Mm-hmm.
But Kiltz got a little owly about something and left. I can't remember what it was about now.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I had to take sides. It was either with the old doctor or with the new one. And Dr. Wright has been out there a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't say, you get out, I'm going to stay with this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So they both, the building is mine, always was mine.
Mm-hmm.
Until I sold it. I believe Brian
and Ed bought it.
And Ed bought it, yeah.
When he retired in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about some of your years on the town council?